You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Late on the night of Saturday, August 15th, civil rights icon Julian Bond died at age 75. He visited Southwest Michigan in January of 2014 to speak at Albion College. I had the pleasure of interviewing him in advance of his lecture. His mind was sharp, not to mention his quick wit. The interview was certainly among the highlights of my career. I hadn't expected him to be as funny and down-to-earth as he was, and then there was the extremely high level of activism he chose to maintain in fighting injustices of all kinds. It was an impressive load for anyone of any age. Today we air an extended version of my interview with Julian Bond from last year. He once had Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as a college professor. Time magazine once named Julian Bond one of America's top 100 leaders. The accomplishments of Julian Bond, who was chairman emeritus of the NAACP, is too long to list here. Bond talked to me about his current activism and his relationship with Dr. King, but also of the state of race relations, which was a focus of his Albion College address. Our interview starts off with Bond telling me what's being done right to advance race relations and what's yet to be done.
Well, what's been done successfully is that if you look at my lifetime only, which is a limited period, even though I'm 74, we've passed laws prohibiting racial discrimination, and generally speaking, they've been successful laws. You now can't deny a person a house because of his or her race. You can't deny them a job because of his or her race, and on and on and on and on. And these are good things. On the other hand, although we have this structure of laws prohibiting racial discrimination actually continues to exist. And it's the continuation of this discrimination that we have yet to eliminate. And that's really the job left for present generations, as well as people in my age group who are still trying to do what we can. There's lots yet undone, and we need to do it.
What's the way to go about doing that? At your time, there were sit-ins. Is that still the way to do it?
That can be the way to do it. There, you know, a number of techniques and methods that people of all races and colors can use to advance their cause. The techniques of yesteryear are still good today. In fact, I'm surprised to the degree that people do not employ a nonviolent protest. It seems to me good in the past, and I think it would be good in the present day, but it apparently has fallen out of favor, and not as many people as I think could tend to employ it today. So there's much that we could be doing: marches, protests, lawsuits, I mean, just a long, long laundry list of things people could do to make sure that this is a decent society for everybody.
How about economic pressure?
Oh, surely. That's always good. We can look around the country and say, in this place, people are employing this. They're boycotting this store. They're doing this about this thing. So you can find, if you look hard enough, I think you can find all of the techniques of yesterday being employed in some measure today. But my contention is that they're not employed as often as they could be or should be. There's more we all could be doing.
I know that you were an associate of King. Can you give me some reflections about King? First, if you can tell our listening audience what was the nature of your contact with King, and tell us a side about him, perhaps maybe that we did not know.
Well, I had a unique relationship with him that I'm very proud to discuss and happy to discuss. I am a student of Dr. King's. You know, a lot of people say that. Oh, yes, I was a student of Dr. King's. But Dr. King only taught one time. He only taught one class. There were only eight people in the class. I'm one of the eight. So I'm one of eight people in the entire universe who can honestly say I was a student of Dr. King. Dr. King taught a course at Morehouse College. He co-taught it with the man who had taught him philosophy. It was a philosophy class. And I was one of eight people, six from Morehouse, two from Spelman College, who took that class. It was a class in philosophy, and I have to admit that I can't recall much of anything that transpired between teacher and student in the class, but I do remember one day he and I were walking across the Morehouse College campus, and I turned to him and I said, "Doc," his friends called him Doc, I said, "Doc, how are you doing?" And he said, "Julian, I'm not doing well." He said, "Unemployment is high, racism seems prevalent, bigotry seems everywhere. I feel awful," he said. "I have a nightmare." And I said, "No, no, no, Doc, turn that around. Why don't you say, I have a dream?" And the rest is history. Of course, I just made that up.
Oh, is that true?
Yes. Oh. It's true I had a class taught by him, but I surely didn't tell him to say I have a dream.
Very good story. Good story. Tell us about the private band. I imagine, you know, yes, you had that student-teacher relationship, but it did progress beyond that.
Not a great deal. I can't say I was his very best friend, but I think people think of him as a kind of somber figure, and I think he portrayed himself as a somber figure in public. And like many public people, he had a public face and a private face. And the private face was very different from the public face. You see this man dressed in a dark suit, smiling occasionally, but typically serious-minded and serious acting. But he was a funny person. He liked to tell jokes. He liked to tease people. Among his friendly circle, he was always teasing people. He believed, against all the evidence, that he was a great basketball player, but he was relatively short in stature and could not, although that's not a prohibition against being a good basketball player, it seemed to be so for him. And he was a person who enjoyed life, and I don't think you get that from the public king, but you certainly could get it from the private king.
There's the 50th birthday of the March on Washington for Freedom and Jobs. I have interviewed a gentleman recently who, in fact, actually was at the original march and went to the commemorative one. Were you at the commemorative one?
Yes, both of them. You know, they had two commemorative ones.
Yes.
I went to both of them.
Were you at the first one as well?
I was at the first one, yes. I was then working for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it was one of the sponsoring organizations of the march, and each organization was asked to give staff members to staff the march, and I was chosen as one of the staff members from SNCC. And part of my job was distributing speeches. Each of the speakers was asked to deliver a copy of his or her speech, or really his speech, because there were no official women speakers at the march.
We're talking about the one in 1963.
The original 63 mm-hmm. march, right. Mm-hmm. So I passed out John Lewis's speech to the media, and I was careful to point out that John was the only speaker to say black people instead of Negroes or colored people, as was the fashion of the day. I thought that demonstrated how militant we were. The newspapers seemed not to be interested in the slightest way. But part of my job, too, was giving Coca-Colas to the movie stars. And I gave a Coca-Cola to Sammy Davis Jr., and he pointed his finger at me like someone holding a gun and said, "Thanks, kid." That's one of my great memories of the March on Washington.
When you went back for the commemorative marches, what ran through your mind? Did you tear up?
No, I didn't tear up, because there had been another commemoration somewhere midpoint between that, I guess 25 years after the original march.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was sort of a return to familiar ground. It was a sort of mixed occasion. On the one hand, happy that we've had this 50th celebration, or these two celebrations a few days apart. President Obama, as you know, spoke at one of them, and a pantheon of famous people spoke at both of these commemorative marches. I spoke at both of them. And I kept thinking, why are we having two? Why are we having two? And to this date, I don't know what the answer to that question is, but we did have two. And they were generally well attended, one more so than the other, but they were happy occasions, sad occasions in the sense that there are people who should have been there who could not be there because they passed away, but happy because those of us who could be there were there and got to see each other again for at least one last time.
Fast forwarding to present day, you do spend a lot of time on college campuses. Right now, you have an affiliation with American University.
I am a professor in residence. It sounds as if I live there, but I don't live there. I'm not sure what that means, but that's okay. I'm happy to take it. What it means, I teach there.
Uh-huh.
I teach on Monday afternoons and have done so for 20-plus years. I taught at the University of Virginia until May of last year,
mm-hmm.
and I've taught at Harvard, at Williams.
And I believe Drexel. So you spent a lot of time on college campuses. Here's what I'm wanting to know. You were very active, obviously. Yes, you continue to be active with civil rights, but in a very, very, very hands-on way when you were a college student. And I think that's the part that kind of fascinates me a little bit. We were talking a little bit off air about my college days, and I was saying that you were quite the rock star in my day when I went to college in terms of activism. I was involved myself with some activism. But I was interviewing a children's author, African-American children's author recently, Walter Dean Myers, who's a
Oh, sure.
New York Times bestselling author. And one of the things he talked about is a knowledge gap. And he was talking about, you know, a lot of young people aren't reading, but perhaps maybe just in general, just not reading as widely. And they don't know about a lot of things. I am curious to know, in all those many years that you've taught over those 20 years or so, tell me about the knowledge level of students, but also Americans in general, about civil rights and our history in regards to that.
When I first became a college teacher, it's something I had never done before, and I wanted to make sure I wouldn't speak down to my students. And I was teaching at Harvard, and I constructed a test of their knowledge to see what they really knew, so I wouldn't be, you know, just repeating things they already knew. And I was disappointed to find out that they didn't know much. And it's interesting, the Southern Poverty Law Center has a little adjunct group called Teaching Tolerance, and they, 3 years ago, conducted a study of the readiness of high school students in America for further learning about the civil rights movement. And the findings were just pathetic. They knew two names, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, and four words, "I have a dream." And that generally sums up the knowledge that high school students in America had on civil rights. They're just about to release a catch-up survey done recently, and the results are a little better, but not as great as you'd get them to be. And they've got a list of states, all the states, and the states have various grades. And it's interesting that the states that tend to have the highest grades are the states with the biggest black population. Now, that's good news and bad news. It's good news that they're teaching civil rights at all. The bad news is that it suggests that they think it's only something that black people ought to be interested in. That's not true, and that's not the case, and I hope that's not why they do it. But so the improvement, there's been an improvement, but it's not as great as one would have to think or hope would happen.
I have a few follow-up questions regarding that. One, why is it that you believe that all races need to know about civil rights, that it's not exclusively something for African-Americans?
It's American history. You know, this is not black history. This is American history. This is the history of Americans, black, white, of all races and colors, who struggled to improve our democracy and who succeeded to some extent. And it's a story that needs to be told. All of us need to learn it so we can learn how to keep doing it, how to continue this path. And unless we know what happened in the past, we can't do it in the future.
You talked about that there are certain things that young people do seem to know about civil rights. What are the parts, and I realize it's a very large history, but what are the parts that you wish that they knew more about? If you could be very specific.
I wish young people, college-age young people, high school-age young people, knew that this movement was conducted to a large part by people just like themselves. The numbers of high school students, the numbers of college students who were active in the movement and who worked, who suffered and who sacrificed and who lost their lives is something that's not as well known as it ought to by others. You know, this year we're celebrating, or celebrating is not the right word, we're memorializing the Freedom Summer from 1964, in which about 1,000 young people, most of them white, spent the summer in Mississippi registering voters, creating opportunity, expanding rights, and three of them died in this struggle. Mickey Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman. And we're commemorating them this year. It's a sad anniversary, but their sacrifice ought to be better known by more and more people. There's a documentary called Freedom Summer, which is going to air sometime this summer about that, and Americans will pick up a little more knowledge about it than that, but they shouldn't have to look at TV to learn about these things. They ought to learn them in school.
You've been listening to an archived West Southwest interview with the late civil rights icon, Julian Bond. He died Saturday from a brief illness. We are talking a lot about students, but in general, how about adults? How are we doing in terms of our knowledge level of civil rights?
Well, you know, adults used to be students. They suffered from going to these schools that didn't teach this subject as well as they might, and so their knowledge is relatively limited. I lead a civil rights tour of southern states every year for the last 6 years, and most of the people who come on this tour are people who are curious about it and want to know more. They know something, but they want to know much more, and they're on my tour, they meet people who made the movement, the people who are survivors who are still living, and who can say, "I was there, I talked to Dr. King, or I did this thing, or I did this thing." And many of them describe it as a life-changing experience. These are people who know something about the movement, but who want to learn more and want to learn it from the people who did it and who made it. And this tour gives them an opportunity. And there are other tours of this sort that take place around the country. And there are large numbers of young people. I find when I go to Birmingham, for example, when we go to the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum, there's always a busload of kids from some place in the country at the museum learning things. So you have to think the knowledge is improving, but it's not improving as fast a rate as you'd hope it would.
We've been talking a lot about young people and actually the power of young people. And if there's any doubt that they can be powerful, you talked earlier about how the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee helped be a co-sponsor of the original March on Washington. But what I also want to point out is about yourself, that your testimony in regards to that. When you were in college at Morehouse in Atlanta, you actually, I know you went for a short period and then you did drop out, but around that time, you were elected to the Georgia House.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well, not so amazing. I was 25, and I was the youngest legislator then, but not the youngest ever. Long before my time, there had been people older than that elected to the Georgia legislature, so being elected at that time was not unique. But yes, I did get elected to the Georgia legislature, and they threw me out, and I got reelected again, and they threw me out again, and got reelected a third time, and finally that stuck.
Talking about being thrown out, let's talk about you just even trying to get seated there to begin with. My understanding is that when you were first elected to the Georgia legislature, that they refused to seat you. This was back, what, in 1965, somewhere in and
yes.
around there, because of your opposition to the Vietnam War and the draft.
Right.
And the lower courts actually affirmed their decision, but it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, and I remember sitting in the court next to my lawyer's law partner in the spectator section of the court and listening to the Attorney General of Georgia telling the court that Georgia had the right to throw me out. And in the middle of his argument, Justice Byron White, better known as Wizard White, because he had been a football player in college, interrupted him, as the justices will do. And he said to him, "Is this all you have?" He said, "You come all this way and this is all you have?" And I hunched my lawyer's partner. I said, "We're winning, aren't we?" And he said, "Yes, we are." And we did. We won 9-0. The court ruled in my favor. And so I was seated finally after much struggle to get in there.
What's further interesting, and I think your life shows this, is it's a lesson in perseverance. You get to the House, but yet they kept redistricting you over and over your districts, yet you kept being reelected.
Yes. I enjoyed being in the Georgia legislature. It was one of the most pleasant experiences of my life. I spent 20 years there in the House and the Senate and rose to some prominence because if you stay there long enough, you get rewarded for that. I was chairman of a committee. I was chairman of my delegation into the legislature. It was the largest delegation, the delegation from Fulton County, which is Atlanta. And so I enjoyed serving there as one of the high points of my life.
Tell me, what lessons do you have to share for young people, for adults, just about persevering, staying in there? What has kept you going?
Well, I always thought if I try something and fail, I ought to try it again. And if I fail a second time, I can even try it again. And maybe on the third time or even the fourth time, I may succeed. And so that taught me that I ought not give up when something fails the first time. There's another opportunity to see whether or not failure is just endemic and going to continue on, or we're going to succeed. And I've tried it often enough and succeeded often enough to make me know that it's better to say, let's try it one more time.
Speaking of trying one more time, I know that I believe you went to Morehouse for about a year or so, and then you dropped out and you came back at age 31 to finish your degree, and you stuck.
No, I actually went to Morehouse for 3.5 years.
3.5 years.
I was in the middle of my last semester
to
graduate when I dropped out.
Oh, but you came back.
Not the best time to graduate, but I came.
But you came back at age 31.
I took the courses I needed, and I graduated and became a Morehouse College graduate, of which I'm quite proud.
Tell me, what do you think is the solution? Actually, before I say that, Tell me about the state of race relations today. I know that is what you are going to be addressing, but are you disturbed by it?
Oh, yes. I think the state of race relations, you know, is hard to sum up in the conversation we're having, but it is better than it used to be and not as good as it could be. It's better than it was when I was in college. I mean, much, much better. Black people, speaking of black people only, and we're not speaking of black people only when we talk about race relations, but black people only are in better condition now than was true when I was a kid. I was a college student. But there are things that harm black people today in our society, or black people, measurements that judge how well or how poorly people are doing, black people still range on the bad side of that equation, and we need to correct that.
It's my understanding that the unemployment rate is adversely really affecting minorities at substantial levels.
Oh, absolutely true. And, you know, if you want to know what the black unemployment rate is, just look at the white unemployment rate and double that. That's always true. That's always true in American society. And, of course, I don't think anybody who thinks that ought to be so, or that's a proper way to have things happen. Since there's so much unanimity on how bad a thing this is to have happen, you'd think that we'd do something more about it than we're doing now.
Some of the big issues that you're involving yourself with these days, my understanding is economic justice is one of them, environmental concerns is one of them, gay rights is one of them. Tell me a little bit about why you have passions in those various areas. I know, for example, that I know that you boycotted Coretta Scott King's funeral. My understanding is because it was held at a church that opposed same-sex marriage. And apparently while she was living, she was a strong supporter of same-sex marriage.
She was. And it's something I think most people don't know about her. That's one of the things about the civil rights movement that we don't know, that she was a strong, strong supporter of same-sex marriage and spoke at rallies and acted out in favor of sexual equality and did everything that she could as a living person to make this possible. And when she was funeralized at a church which was pastored by a raving homophobic pastor, I just couldn't go to that. I couldn't find myself there, and so I didn't go.
What makes you passionate about same-sex marriage and gay rights? It's obviously a controversial issue in the civil rights movement, particularly in the black church, the traditional black church. I'm sure you've gotten a lot of flack for that yourself. What is it that you would like our listener audience to know about that?
I have gotten a lot of flack for it, but interestingly, the flack has diminished. I think attitudes are changing not only among black Americans, but among Americans generally. Just in the newspaper today, there's a story about some state legislature or some court action advancing the cause of same-sex marriage. I think here's an issue that I had to approach when I was working for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or even when I was in college. I went to college with gay people, gay men from Morehouse College, and you know there were all these jokes and laughter about this guy and this guy and this guy, and it also always seemed so small-minded, so simple-minded to laugh at John or Frank because he had a same-sex attraction that my other college colleagues did not have. And this was something he had been born with, not something he chose to do. And how can you blame a person for some condition that he's born with? How can you, it just seemed intolerable to me that you could do that. These were decent people. They were friendly people. Some of them were nice people. Some of them were not nice people. But they were people, and they didn't deserve to be mistreated because of some condition they'd been born with. And I just couldn't find that tolerable.
Yeah, I remember reading an interview, and I'm trying to see where it's at exactly, but I don't know if it's called Two Nations of Black America. But in any case, it's an interview where you talk about that gays and lesbians are discriminated in that, you said, in the past and present in the same way that, you know, not in the same way, but
like blacks are, the fact that they are, and that they're born in a certain way, in the same way that blacks are born, being black, and that
yes, and
cannot,
you know,
be changed.
One of the problems I think gay people face is the ignorance of the larger population that thinks they've chosen to, this life that they live, when in fact they were born to it. And some of these people were active in the civil rights movement with me. They helped me to win my civil rights. And I can't turn around now and say, listen, thanks for helping me, but I'm not going to help you. I mean, that's just something I could not do, and I don't think anybody would do if they understood the role they'd played in helping me. You know, if it hadn't been for a gay man, there would not have been a successful march on Washington. Byard Rustin was the organizer of the march. He was openly gay. He was honestly and expressionally gay. Didn't care who knew it. That was who he was. And he helped to make that march the great success that it was. Now, how can I turn around and say, well, I'm not going to the march because Byard Rustin is gay? I mean, how stupid would I be if I said that, if that was my attitude?
As we bring this interview to a close, let's talk about some of your environmental, your passion in that area. Where does that come from? Is that something that you've always had, or what makes you attach yourself to those issues now?
I don't think I've always had it. I've grown into it as I've become conscious, as more and more Americans have, of what we're doing to our environment. You know, our air and water are not as clean as they ought to be, and all of us ought to be concerned about this. Why do we let our air become foul? Why do we let our water become foul? You see what's happening today. I can't even remember where it was. There's some state where people can't drink their water, some small town where, because of environmental depredations, they can't drink their drinking water. Can you imagine that? Waking up and turning on your tap water and finding out you can't drink it. So this ought to concern everybody. It shouldn't be just some people who are derided as tree huggers or people who are nutty about these things. Everybody ought to be concerned about these things.
And finally, I want to harken back to when you were growing up. You came from a very learned family. Your mother was a former librarian at Clark Atlanta University, and your father had been president of a couple of colleges, actually.
Right.
And a number of well-known people would stop by the house. I understand W.E. Du Bois, Paul Robeson. I know you were still quite young, but anybody stands out to you?
Well, I have a great picture of myself with my sister, with Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson has his arm around me, and he's singing one of his favorite songs, a Russian folk song, The Four Insurgent Generals. And I remember, I must have been 7, 8 years old, feeling his chest vibrate against me. You know, he had this deep, deep baritone voice, and he's singing this Russian folk song. And it was just a thrilling, thrilling moment. And I also have a picture of Dr. Du Bois and my father and E. Franklin Frazier, three men dressed in their academic regalia, and my sister and myself, and a document that the three of them signed dedicating my sister and myself to a life of scholarship. And it's a treasure I have. And, you know, my father was college president and at a black college, at two black colleges, and they used to be the places where prominent black people could find an audience. And so a parade of prominent black people were in and out of our house.
Is there any final thoughts that you would like to share with us?
Well, people who hear this and who are interested in these issues ought to join some, if they're not now a member of some organization, they ought to join some organization. Some organization that's fighting for the things they believe in and join in themselves. We need them. And they'd be welcome to join these groups and do what they can to make sure America becomes a better place.
Mr. Bond, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to civil rights icon Julian Bond, who died late Saturday night. Visit our webpage at WMUK.org to learn more about his life. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.